Hi there, and thank you for tuning in to Asking for a Friend. My name is Katrina Buffard, and I'm a clinical sexologist and psychotherapist. This podcast provides you with evidence-based information and real-world advice about getting to know yourself better sexually, and it covers all those topics that we would rather ask about for a friend. Just a warning, this podcast may contain conversations of a sexual nature and isn't suitable for kids. Every year, as a woman, I get a reminder to have a pap smear. But do you know why you need this? And did you know that having your pap smear is only testing for a few strains of the sexually transmitted infection, human papillomavirus, or HPV? This week's episode delves into this topic with the wonderful and brilliant gynecologist, Dr. Mpumi Zenda. Dr. Mpumi is a passionate obstetric gynecologist sexologist practicing in Johannesburg. She's a social media presence and is passionate about providing solutions to sexual and reproductive health and wellness through connecting media and medicine. We bust myths, tell you what you really need to know, break down what HPV is, and talk a little bit about how we wish things would change in order to eradicate cervical cancer. We speak a lot to the experiences of women, but this episode is for everyone. Dr. Mpumi, I'm so chuffed that I get to speak to you today on the podcast, and it's about a topic that I really feel we need to be talking more about.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Katrina. And, you know, this is one of my, I'd say favorite, but also it's something that is so common. I see so commonly in my practice. So I'm so glad you're doing this.
Well, already that makes me, I don't know if I should use the word happy, but relieved to hear, because so often I speak to people who just feel so isolated by getting an abnormal pap result, you know, and a diagnosis of HPV, and feeling like, you know, what have I done wrong? I was not promiscuous, you know, I don't sleep around, I'm responsible. There's so much stigma around STIs in general, but I guess yeah. With HPV, I would love to like kind of go into it and unpack it with you to make more sense of why and how it is that this very, very common, you know, infection that we can all experience has the kind of associations that it does. But I think the best place for us to start is just, you know, what is HPV?
Right. So HPV is actually a human papillomavirus. It's a group of it's, you know, these different strains. And, you know, when you look at the research, although they've probably kind of, you know, pointed out to the T about 40, they do estimate that there's probably even more than that, like up to 100 strains. Now, the biggest reason we focus so much on HPV is because of the high risk strains that tends to cause, 70% of the time tends to cause cervical cancer. It doesn't mean that it can only cause cervical cancer. It can cause oropharyngeal, it can cause anal, penile cancer, but significantly more, it is the cervical cancer. Now, you know, you talk about stigma, and it's quite a big thing, because in fact any STI, like you said, is associated with a lot of stigma. It's associated with, you know, I find couples in a relationship starting to look at each other like, who did what? And it is so important for people to understand that, first of all, you know, human papilloma is very transmittable just on contact, you know, vaginal, whether it's heterosexual couples, whether it's, you know, couple same-sex couples, exactly the same. It's very easy. You don't have to even have a breakage of a skin, so to speak. And it is the most common STI. Naturally, our bodies are supposed to be able to get rid of and literally eliminate it from our system. But with all sorts of other things coming to play, your immune system, you know, exposure, that tends to be a big contributing factor. So definitely a big stigma, but the real concern that we have and why we zoom in into HPV is because of the risk of cervical cancer in particular. And the fact that it is so preventable, you know, to, the precancerous lesions are so treatable, such that technically speaking, no woman should actually be dying of cervical cancer in this day and age. And yet we still see significant amounts of women who die from this, particularly in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa. It is a massive statistic in terms of the number of people that still die from cervical cancer.
I mean, that's crazy. You know, I was speaking to Professor Elna McIntosh last month during Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And one of the things that she really emphasized was that early detection saves lives. And I guess I'm hearing the same thing from you, is testing and treatment saves lives when it comes to HPV.
100%. And I think, you know, I would even go as far as adding awareness, because, you know, when you look at the number of women who show up for their pap smears, it is ridiculous. The uptake in terms of, you know, checking in the form of pap smears, it's ridiculous. And a lot of women are hesitant, apprehensive about going to a healthcare to get their pap smears done. So awareness is also just as important. We don't have enough drive, whether it's in the media, whether it's in our social media, in terms of talking about this, to demystify and destigmatize just talking about the topic and allowing women to feel free to go and understand that it is for their absolute benefit to get screened early. And even if your pap smear is abnormal, that is something that we probably can treat, rather than 5, 10, 15 years later, you know, you rock up, you're now with, cancer, which is so much more devastating and just invasive in terms of the kind of treatment that goes into it.
There is just so much there that we need to unpack and we need to talk about. What are the prevalence rates? I mean, do you know kind of the prevalence of HPV locally in South Africa or globally, perhaps?
There's a big difference between the prevalence of HPV, because anyone who is sexually active will at least in their lifetime, you know, get HPV. So that's how prevalent it is.
So if you haven't had sex, if you've never had sex.
That's the only safety net in terms of.
Got it. Okay.
So, and so people have to understand the difference between the prevalence of HPV in terms of the virus itself does not necessarily mean that you already have cervical changes, so to speak. And it also does not mean that you have cancer, because those are three different entities in terms of when you talk about prevalence. When you talk about prevalence in terms of prevalence of cancer, cervical cancer in particular, at least, you know, globally it's reported at least about 690,000 women per year. And then what is even worse off is when you look at our country, South Africa, cervical cancer is the commonest commonest cancer amongst women, particularly amongst Black women, because there is this link around poor socioeconomic. It is crazy. You know, the number of cases per year are ridiculous. I mean, if you think about 690 globally, 690,000, it's too much.
I was about to say to you, just to confirm, that's nearly 700,000 women a year globally. That is a whopping number.
Yeah, and these were, I think these were from about 2018. You know, which is like I said, it is scary. You know, if you had to look 10, 20 years, because of the advancements, you kind of could say, okay. But we don't seem to be moving in the direction where it is decreasing significantly, based on all the advances from the vaccines to the improved kind of testings that we do now that we didn't have back then. It is scary that we still have such high numbers.
So the thing that you mentioned that stood out for me was that Black women are more susceptible. I mean, why is that? Is it because of lack of access to healthcare and something like, you know, prevention with pap smears? What is the reason behind that?
Oh, it is definitely related to the socioeconomic. And if you look, you know, the big discrepancies in our country is that you have like grand inequalities. So if you look at, for example, private sector, you almost find over-treating. You find women going and having pap smears almost every single year, which may not be necessary. Of course, there are times where we individualize and somebody actually does need to have a pap smear every year. But in general, just the general rule, you find there's over-treating in the private sector. And then you look in the public sector, which can be scary. You know, a lot of it, starting with the guidelines, for example. The guidelines say a woman from at least an age of 25 can start having their pap smear and should at least have a pap smear every 10 years. Now, that's not enough. Also, in the public sector, we don't have availability of actual HPV testing as yet. We still just do cytology only. Now, that also, if you look at the 10-year period, so much can happen. Somebody can literally, you know, have a precancerous and move all the way to cancer within the 10-year if they've just only had one, you know, pap smear. So the policies themselves are not adequate, but also in terms of access, some people will go and get their pap smears, but never get their results. Results get lost, or they, you know, they basically what we call lost to follow up. Even people who have abnormal pap smears in the public sector, sometimes it is so hard to get the person to come back, and then they have a colposcopy, and if they need further treatment, whether it's the LEDs, whether they need to go to you know, theater for it. And even, like, for example, early stages of cancer, you find that in terms of the turnaround time between the pap smear being done and the treatment being instituted, it there's just too much time that lapses, and then therefore allows for you know, people coming in late or being detected late that they've got cancer at advanced stages, which is, like I said, is just, it's sad.
It really is, because as you've really emphasized just now that it's so preventable, and this is we could eradicate cervical cancer. It would be something relatively easy to do if we had the ability to offer every woman access to pap smears and, you know, colposcopies and so on. So I guess I'm wanting to understand the process for a woman, all right? So a woman comes to see you for her pap smear. And she has her pap smear, assuming she can have one, because I work with a lot of women that can't have pap smears due to sexual pain. But the majority of these women have not had sex before. So again, as you said, that's the safety net. So a woman comes to see you, she's had her pap smear, and she gets an abnormal result. What is the next step?
So there's a number of things that we have to look at. First of all, it depends what is the abnormal pap. What are the findings? Because there's a number of things that we would look at in terms of the actual, you know, results. There's what we grade, we kind of grade it. There's what you call the low grade SIL, which is basically sort of like early changes, but we're not thinking it's high risk as yet. And also, it also depends on what was the previous pap smear, if she had had a previous pap. So for example, somebody who's had an abnormal pap in their previous, and then they're having another one, that's what we call that recurrent or persistent. The treatment then is a bit more, is different. So that person, automatically, if they've had a previous abnormal pap, they automatically fall into the category of those that you need to go and do a colposcopy and do a biopsy, and may need or may not need LEDs. Somebody who's got an abnormal Pap for the first time, and it is that at low grade, you may repeat the Pap. You may repeat the Pap smear in about a year's time. If they are HIV positive, so that's an underlying disease that affects somebody's immune system. In fact, HIV in particular has a great impact on how quickly the disease advances. So somebody who's got an underlying HIV, for example, will have a repeat Pap smear much earlier if they've got an abnormal Pap for the first time, so in within 6 months. And then if somebody has already got a, you know, HP, which is a high grade, that is a danger because you are literally at the point where it's just before you get to the cancer. I think also something that is very important to highlight is that a Pap smear, remember, it's not a diagnostic test. It is a screening test. So it is also possible that somebody comes in with an abnormal Pap, and that's why something like a high grade, for example, you automatically take them for a colposcopy. You do further testing, colposcopy, biopsy, and they may or may not need a full a LES. So what we call a large loop excision of the transformation zone, which is basically it's almost like coring out the cervix, if I can call it that. It's not as hectic as it sounds. It's actually quite a simple procedure. You don't even have to go to theater in most cases. So there is a lot of individualizing in terms of when somebody comes in with an abnormal Pap. There's quite a number of things, as I've mentioned, that you have to consider to decide whether this is something that we can wait and just repeat the Pap smear again, or if it's something that where we need to go to the next step, which is, like I said, going to do a colposcopy, and you want a diagnostic procedure in somebody that you already are suspecting something like a high grade still.
Okay, and I think it may be just helpful for me to say to my listeners that a colposcopy is a procedure you would use to find cancerous or abnormal cells on the cervix, the vagina, the vulva even. Is that accurate?
Yes, absolutely.
And you're looking to make sure that the cells that you're finding aren't cancerous, and if they are, then needing to take it further, as you mentioned, with those other procedures. So for a woman who's come in, she's had her Pap smear, it's come back with an abnormal but low-grade result, that means that she just needs to come back annually to have her Pap smear. Is that right?
Accurate, yes.
Accurate. Okay. So annually she has a Pap smear. If we have a woman who's in a monogamous relationship and she's sexually active with one person only, and she's had several, you know, a couple of years of negative or of normal Pap smears, how often should she test?
At least every 3 to 5 years. But also, I just want to put this out there that it, you know, the guidelines differ from country to country. Also, over and above that, if somebody has a, they have access to what we call now HPV testing or co-testing. So the cytology, which is looking at your own cells, your cervical cells. And then the HPV testing is actually looking if there is a strain that has been found in your cervix. So if somebody has done co-testing, what it helps with actually is that if somebody does an HPV test and there wasn't a high risk strain that was found, is that they actually have a bit more leeway in terms of time. So instead of 3 years, you can check them every 5 years. I know that a lot of women are very anxious about, especially when they actually can go and get a Pap smear done every year or every 2 years. A lot of women will still go and ask for a Pap smear much earlier, much sooner than that. I think where for me it always helps is also to take away this burden where somebody, for whatever reason, hasn't been to have their Pap smear in like 2-3 years, and they come in literally cringing into your rooms, and they're like, "Oh, doc, I haven't done please don't feel bad. You are here now. Let's get it done. But in terms of the gut, at the very least, 3 to 5 years, depending on the type of testing that somebody has done, whether it's a code testing or if it's just a cytology. What also is important, like I said, if somebody has underlying comorbid diseases that affect their immunity, particularly HIV, then you have to do it much earlier. So somebody who's HIV positive, if they've had an abnormal PAP, they do have to go in every single year. The only time that you actually do stop or you go back to the 3 to 5 years is if the, especially if it's something like a low grade, if it resolves. Because remember, I also want women to be aware that just because you have an abnormal PAP this year, it doesn't mean next year it'll still be abnormal. It can resolve. Your body can actually clear it out, and quite often, especially if it is low grade and there was no HPV, especially the high strains found, it does resolve. Sometimes you get something that is sort of like an in-betweener that we call ascus, or atypical changes of unknown origin. So we don't know whether the changes of the cervix are as a result of the HPV, or it's as a result of just minor infections like what we call cervicitis, as a result of either, somebody who's got recurrent yeast or what we call thrush infections. So that can also have an effect on the cervix. So you do get this like gray zone-ish that we call ascus, and that can resolve as well. So that's why we don't ever want to over-treat, because we would end up literally chopping women's services just for no reason.
Yeah, and that's definitely not a thought that I think any woman would feel comfortable with. You know, you want to know that your doctor has your best interests at heart, and over-treating is problematic. So yeah. Now, what about men? How do men experience HPV? Can we test men for HPV? And what do men need to know about this infection?
It's so crazy because I just had this conversation with a client yesterday, and you know, whether we are talking, in fact, contraception, maybe there is this, you know, there are small steps in the right direction in terms of, you know, male contraceptives, so to speak, is how much as well something like this becomes the burden of the woman. And this is not because HPV does not affect men, but it's because it predominantly affects women in the form of cervical cancer, vulval, vaginal, but predominantly cervical. So men can get penile anal cancer, can get, you know, oropharyngeal. But what is difficult is we don't have a method of testing men for HPV as yet. And the crazy thing, like I said, is that it is transmittable between couples. So they are carriers. They are carriers. And sometimes you'll find, you know, a woman will say, I've done the most. I have not, you know, slept around. But if your partner, like any STI, if there's a discrepancy in how the relationship is going between the two partners, and someone else is getting things from elsewhere, it obviously impacts on the partner, on the other partner. So no, there is nothing. And unfortunately, even when you look at things like, and I'm sure we're going to chat about this a bit later on, prioritizing, you know, things like vaccines, the focus has been on the girl child, on the woman, and not necessarily on the men, which very often it's related to, you know, the politics, the budgets, and so to speak, and obviously the person who bears the brunt of the disease, which is the woman. But I think there is so much room that it doesn't get spoken about in terms of vaccinating young boys as well, because, well, most of the time, who are the girls having sex with? And then also just what can the man do? I still, I still prescribe when somebody, if they've never been given a vaccine, for example, I will still prescribe to both the woman and the man in terms of the vaccine.
That is so interesting. And I want to delve into that in a moment, because I think that that's a topic we really do need to explore and promote, so to speak. But the one thing I was just wondering, you know, we've spoken a little bit about HPV and pap smears and testing internally, but can we talk a little bit about what symptoms, you know, people can experience with HPV externally on their genitals?
Right. So you do get particularly the strains 6 and 11 that cause genital warts. It's literally just warts. They are generally not painful, but if not attended to, they can grow really big. They can get infected, and when they are infected, they can bleed. They can be quite offensive in the smell. Worst case scenarios, they literally look like huge cauliflower that is infected, and yeah, like I said, they can bleed. Also, what is important to understand is that is also because you don't just think about, you know, the woman and the partner. You think about if the woman falls pregnant and they've got genital warts during labor, it is possible to transmit HPV to the child during delivery. So it is not just, you know, just because they are not cancerous doesn't mean that they are innocuous, so to speak.
I think that that's such an interesting point. And I mean, it's the same with most STIs as well, with herpes simplex virus and things like that. We don't often associate, you know, childbirth with an STI, but we do need to consider it. And I think, again, what you're saying is if somebody does develop genital warts, it's something that needs to be treated. So don't just ignore it and pretend it's going to go away, or by ignoring and hoping it's going to go away. It is actually something that needs to be attended to. And so when you're seeing women in your practice, that's something that you can assist them with so that it doesn't get to that worst case scenario, as you mentioned, which I can imagine that my listeners are cringing. You know, you and I deal with this stuff every day, but for somebody who doesn't, hearing about this kind of infected cauliflower looking thing on one's vulva is going to cause the heebie-jeebies for a lot of women. But as you're saying, it doesn't have to get to that stage, and it shouldn't get to that stage. So again, prevention is important here. I think that that's something that obviously we're trying to get the message out during this chat. And men can experience them too. So, you know, who should men visit? If women are seeing a gynecologist, who should men visit to go and have those genital warts treated?
Urologist, they're urologist.
Great. Okay. So if a man's listening to this and he has got a genital wart, or he's noticed something unusual on his genitals or around his genitals, on his anus or so on, go and see a urologist. So then let's delve back into that discussion we were starting about treatment for HPV. And I guess something that is interesting is you were talking about how if a woman has an abnormal pap smear 1 year, but then a normal pap smear there on out, you know, that's the virus kind of resolving itself, or the body fighting it off. What exactly is that about? And is it possible to get HPV if you've been vaccinated?
Okay, let's start with the first question. So remember, HPV is the actual virus that basically sort of like embeds itself, or it integrates itself into your own cervical cells, and that's what would then cause the changes. But like any virus, whether it's a flu, your body has an immunity that is supposed to be able to fight off. What is quite interesting as well is the fact that while somebody may not have any changes at all, so the body is doing the most in terms of fighting that off or clearing the virus, but you can, if you're doing, for example, the testing, the HPV testing, you can pick up the strain of the virus without some, with somebody who has a normal cytology. So your cells, or let me, how I always explain it is your body is doing what it needs to be doing in fighting the virus off. But so you can pick it up. And also, you know, couples often look at the, you know, start looking at each other very funny when you know, there's an abnormal pap or we've picked up a strain, and I quickly say to them, this could be from 20 years ago, because that's how long a HPV can last in someone's cervix. So it could be from a partner 2 years ago, it could be from 5 years ago. It doesn't necessarily mean that if I pick up an abnormal pap or a strain of the HPV, that it is from your current situation.
That's interesting, Dr. Mpumi, because I work with a lot of couples where the woman does get an abnormal pap result, and immediately the lens is turned onto each other as partners. Like, what have you been doing? Where have you been? And I know I asked you a second question, and I'm going to park it for a second and come back to it, because this does speak to the stigma around STIs, right? It's quite funny, actually. It's a bit like COVID. You know, when we first started experiencing lockdowns globally and this wave of COVID that swept across the world, the initial response to COVID, I felt, was much like that of STIs. Where have you been? What have you been doing? Have you been irresponsible? Did you not wear your mask? It's exactly the same as how people generally respond to an STI, as like, oh my goodness, you've been promiscuous. You weren't wearing a condom. You must have been irresponsible. I've been quite bemused by the similarities. And also, you know, there's been a lot of stigma around COVID initially in a lot of communities. So the stigma that exists and the way that the partners kind of turn the lens on each other and point fingers, I'm really glad that you emphasize there, like, this, like, you stop your patients and you're like, this could have been there 20 years ago. This is not about you and him, you know, you were the two of you as a couple. This is something that could have been there many, many, many decades ago. And I see that so often, and I'm having to help couples navigate and understand that. And I often find it's because there's misinformation. So I know I parked that question, and I will come back to it, but the stigma that exists, why is such a stigma? And in particular around HPV, I hear a lot of stigma around HPV.
Yeah. There is stigma around any STIs, and it is for that reason, you know, partially is because, first of all, just generally and globally, is that we don't have enough sex positivity. We don't talk very positively about sex and sexuality. There is so much taboos and, you know, hush hush. So it doesn't give people who are going through whatever just the permission and the opportunity to say, I've got this, I need it sorted out. So that's the one part of it. It's just when you look at anything that has to do with sex and sexuality, just the general stigma around sex and the lack, or let me say the not enough sex positivity, that's where it starts. But also, and I see this a lot, it, particularly for the woman, it's the burden of, it affects mainly 70% of the time, you know, HPV causes cervical cancer, you know, and so who has a cervix? It's the woman. So who bears the burden of having to go and get a pap smear done? I mean, men, to be fair, they don't really go for much of anything. So it's the woman who bears the burden of having to go. And also there is this unspoken thing where the minute a woman has an abnormal pap, whether it is from their partner, whether it is just, you know, societally, that thing you were talking about where people look and say, what have you been doing? You know, that assumption, what have you been doing? What have you been up to? We saw this a lot with HIV as well. And I think it is so important, when that's why I spoke about, it is important for us to have information, awareness about how these things, how these STIs are contracted, and you know who is at risk, who is more predisposed, and people will actually understand. I always say HPV is one of those that technically it shouldn't have a stigma at all, because chances are, if you've been sexually active, we've all had it.
That was so beautifully put and so clear and concise. And I think just emphasizing, as you did a second time, about how HPV becomes the burden of the woman. You are so right. I mean, the first time that men generally do anything about their kind of reproductive and sexual health organs is when they either are trying to fall pregnant and they're needing fertility testing, or they're going to, you know, check on prostate health and things like that. But for women, as soon as we become sexually active, we need to be seeing a gynecologist or a GP for our pap smears. So it's a lifelong commitment, actually, almost all the time for a woman. And so the burden is there. And you're right. I think there are a lot of similarities between the HIV, HIV and HPV, COVID and HPV. And for me, that's why I want to have these conversations and conversations with somebody like yourself, because I want to debunk myths about something that, as you have just pointed out, almost everybody will get in their life. And that is the need to normalize this type of conversation, where we're treating HPV the same that we would treat influenza. You know, influenza comes around every year. It's also a virus. We don't then go and stigmatize people and say, well, what have you been doing and where have you been doing it? When our partner gets flu, we might be irritated that, you know, they've brought flu home, but we don't start questioning that the trust that we have in the relationship and accusing them of betraying us. So, you know, that would be a dream, that one day somehow, you know, we don't have the stigma associated to it. But I think that that's a tough ask. So let me go back to the question that I was asking you. So the vaccination for HPV, if someone has had this vaccination, can they still get HPV?
So the short answer to that is yes, and it's for two reasons. One, there is no vaccination that is 100%. So when you look at, you know, a lot of the research, it quotes anything between 90% and 99%. The other thing that is also quite interesting when it comes to HPV is the fact that it's got so many strains, and the vaccines that have currently been developed and approved, so far there is the Cervarix, which is it targets the two high 16 and 18, the high risk for cancer. There is the Gardasil, which targets it, which has basically targets four strains, which is 16, 18, which is the high risk, as well as the genital warts one, the 6 and 11. And then I know, I think in the US they've got I think it's called Gardasil 9, where they've got a few more from the high risk strains. I think it's about nine targets. Now, like I said earlier on, if you've got a virus that potentially has, like, you know, 100 strains, it is still possible. The last thing that is important about the vaccine is that, and that's why when you look at policies, they target those, you know, the young girls between the ages of like 9 and 11 to get the vaccine, because it is most effective in somebody who has never been exposed. And that makes sense. But the extension is anybody who is never been vaccinated up to the age of 45, it is still a good idea, especially if they have access. It is still a good idea, because it can prevent, you know, you might have been exposed to, you know, 16, but not to 18. So it prevents, it can still be helpful in preventing or decreasing the chances of contracting the other strains as well.
That is such important information for us to be putting out there. And I want to say that I had the Gardasil vaccination, gosh, many decades ago, I think. I mean, probably at least over a decade ago. In my early 20s, so way over a decade ago. And I was under the impression that once I'd had this vaccination, that's it. No HPV, you know, I'll be fine. So I think that you and I having this discussion is so necessary, because when doctors are suggesting that somebody does get vaccinated, I don't think they're giving their patients enough information. I wasn't given enough information about this. And then, again, it's not just about vaccinating women under a certain age. Up to the age of 45, it's important to be vaccinated, because it does help, as you said, it's not perfect, no vaccine is, but it does help to prevent the strains that we really want to be preventing.
One thing also I just wanted to mention in terms of the vaccine, I think also it's important for people to understand that getting vaccinated when you have been, say, for example, you've had, the vaccine does not treat an abnormal PEP. The vaccine does not, it obviously cannot protect you from a strain that you've already been exposed to. So we also don't want to create the idea that get vaccinated and it will make, you know, the abnormal PEP go away. No, that is not why we're giving the vaccine. The vaccine is strictly to prevent anything that you haven't been exposed to as yet in terms of the strains. But also what is important is that your body builds antibodies that fight against whenever you get exposure. So it's still important, but it's also just as important to understand why do we give it and what is the purpose of it.
And that's crucial, I think, for people to have the correct information about. Because as I've just said, without the correct information, you think kind of, oh, I'm fine, you know, cool. I've had the vaccination. So, HPV is not a problem anymore. The interesting thing is in Australia, they vaccinate boys and girls. What are your thoughts on that? And do you think that should be something that, you know, ideally, obviously, should be happening globally?
100% agree. They are literally on the money, because if you look at the percentage of heterosexual intercourse, it's so much more. And I think even to discriminate and say heterosexual intercourse, what about, for example, in same sex, whether it's females or it's males? So two males who are having intercourse and have never been vaccinated, they are at risk of giving each other HPV literally back and forth, if you understand what I mean. Mm-hmm. So this idea of just the girls, I think the shortfall of it is, first of all, I think it perpetuates the stigmas around HPV, and it creates again that burden for the woman. But secondly, it just doesn't make sense, considering that you don't get HPV by having sex with yourself. You get it by having it with someone else, through the transmission with a partner. And so it is absolutely crucial. And if you vaccinate girls and boys, you are raising a generation that has a significant decrease in the amount of HPV exposure in that particular, you know, generation. And if you do this long enough, you could very easily almost eliminate cervical cancer, so to speak.
I wonder then, like, what do you wish that we were being taught about HPV, you know, in schools, you know, prior to becoming sexually active? What do you wish kids were being educated about before their sexual debut?
It's such a difficult one, because for me personally, it's not just about isolating one particular STI or even STIs. So much goes into, somebody being ready to sexual debut. I think I wish that girls and boys were actually taught more about their bodies. As we transition from childhood to being a young adult, a young woman, a young man, why is my body changing? And so that a teenager can make sense of, you know, the hormonal changes first and foremost, but also how it affects their drive in terms of their sexuality. I think also what's important is when you explain these things, it's just to say to somebody, it is so important for you. You will never understand yourself in totality, particularly as a teenager. And fair enough, you may never make all the best decisions for yourself as a teenager. But at the very least, give yourself the opportunity to understand what you're getting yourself into, what are the risks, how do you want to feel about that particular, whether we call it an event, or how do you want to feel about yourself? I think we don't do enough self-empowering so that somebody is confident and there is less of a chance that people are swayed and pushed into making decisions about things that they're not ready for, that they're not well informed about. And of course, like I said, it doesn't, especially at that age, you know, you're more likely to make mistakes, which is fair. But at the very least, if we just empower young girls, young men to love and own their bodies and protect their bodies and know how to protect their bodies in whatever they engage in, I think for me, that would be a great start.
I concur with you immensely. You know, it's like a lifelong mission how much I try to instill this message of permission in people, because that's never been given to them. And what you're talking about is, can we empower young people in their bodies, in their sexual experiences, and essentially being giving them permission to do so? And it's something that I promote with my clients, and I'll promote with basically anybody who will listen, that we don't get given this. So we actually have to work hard when we're adults to give it to ourselves, to give ourselves permission to explore our sexuality, to learn about our bodies, to be empowered in our bodies. And I think you're right. It's not about tackling one STI or all STIs, but actually about understanding oneself better and having a deeper relationship with one's own body. So, Dr. Mpumi, the last question that I have for you, and I ask it of all my guests at the end of the episode, is what's the most surprising thing about this work that you've been doing, you know, in working with women with HPV or people with HPV? What's the most surprising thing that you could share with us?
I think what always pops out for me, and I'm always pleasantly surprised at how it almost always teaches me as well and reminds me, you're a woman too. This, what they're going through, you know, you are going through yourself. I remember even something as simple as a lot of women, whether it's because of past experiences, whether it's traumatic or just uncomfortable experiences, how women actually think it through the idea of just going to get a pap smear, like, oh my gosh, okay, I need to pick somebody, and how they go through the grueling process of, okay, who am I going to allow into this vulnerable space of mine? And so the surprising thing for me is always that every year as well, I think I have those thoughts. I think to myself, oh, which one of my colleagues am I going to, go and be vulnerable with? And, you know, whilst I wait for the results. But what has been pleasant for me is that it allows me to understand what women are going through when they are anxious about having a pap smear, about an abnormal result, about when I take them to theater for a colposcopy and a lids. So it puts the responsibility for me as a clinician to extend myself beyond just being a technician in terms of, okay, this is what you do, this is what we'll do. It's sitting in and standing in the gap with them and saying, we'll get through this. I don't think enough clinicians have learned that emotional intelligence or have that emotional intelligence. And I think it's partially because we never bring ourselves to the table, our own experiences to the table when we're seeing clients. But when you know what it feels like and you understand, especially somebody who doesn't have as much information as you may have, there's a lot more risk of them being, in an emotional state about something that you may consider very simple and straightforward.
I love that, Dr. Mpumi, the human side of it and realizing, I'm a woman too. I'm here with you. I'm not just here for, here for you as your doctor, but I'm here with you as a woman, as a human being. As a woman who's had many pap smears in my life, I would say that it's obviously not the most pleasant of experiences. It's not the most enjoyable thing. I'm very fortunate that I have a wonderful gynae that I have a great relationship with. And when I love going for my annual appointments because I love seeing her and having, her and I have fat work chats. But it's still not something that I would happily put myself up for because it's just not the greatest experience for women. And so what you've just said has really struck a chord with me because I work with women who have had horrific experiences when trying to have a pap smear because they have, they've already got an existing sexual pain disorder and they're trying to kind of grit and bear it and just get this done. And they're seeing somebody who's got very little compassion or very little understanding about sexual pain and what that means for a woman. And just lacking the real empathic side of this process. And I think that you stand out in what you've just said about that. So thank you. I want obviously people in South Africa, possibly obviously Johannesburg, to be able to come and see you if they're looking for a gynecologist, but also just anyone to reach out to you. So where do people find you and how can they reach you?
So for appointments, I am based at Morningside Medic Clinic and it's in Sandton. But something that I've also really loved and it extends beyond, I don't think people have this idea that, you can have your own gynae, so to speak, but when it comes to information, you don't have to drink from the same well because different clinicians have got so many different things to offer. I look at your work, I look at my sexual health and fair enough, we acquired a network. So what I'm getting at is, for example, our Instagram page has probably been more influential than the visit to a gynae or visit to me. So yes, please do pop in and, in Sandton our rooms, but just for girly girl things that we learn on our Instagram page, which is dr.gynae, so dr.gynae, dr.gynae. We do a lot of chats around, particularly women's health, sex and sexuality.
Thank you. And it's an incredible tool, isn't it, Instagram, as a way to get, really good information from somebody who isn't your gynecologist but is putting out fantastic stuff there. And despite I have a love-hate relationship with Instagram because while I'm trying to get off my phone, I know that Instagram is the most brilliant tool to engage with our clients on really relevant topics such as this. And thank you, Dr. Mpumi, for your time today. I know it's precious, but I have no doubt that a lot of people, women and men, those who identify otherwise, are going to learn a fortune from the chat we've had today.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me, Katrina.
Got a question you'd like to ask for a friend? Reach out to me via my website or Instagram, and I'll be sure to include it in a Q&A episode soon. You can subscribe and follow this podcast on your favorite podcast platform. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please rate and review it.